Well, I've got 15 cents, and I'm going over here and have coffee and donuts. You can sit and watch, if you like. Then we'd better get on the goddamned road before it gets dark and try and get a ride out of here. Hell, Sut, we can't go back empty-handed. But Sutry had already stepped into the street. Rhys watched him cross and enter the cafe on the other side. Sutry borrowed a paper from a stack by the till as he went in, and he sat at the counter. A fat man asked him what he would have. Coffee, he wrote on the ticket. Do you have any donuts?
Plain of chocolate.
Chocolate. He wrote that. Sutry craned his neck to see the price. The fat man went down the counter, and Sutry opened his paper. He drank 3 cups of coffee and read the paper from front to back. Finally, he folded the paper and went to the front and paid his bill and put the paper back and went out. He stood in the street, picking his teeth and looking up and down. He waited around for the better part of an hour. The stores were closing. He eyed the failing sun. That son of a bitch, he said. He was passing a small cafe when something about a figure within stopped him. He stepped back and peered through the glass. At a booth in the little lunchroom was Rhys. He was buttering up large chunks of cornbread. Before him sat a platter of steak and gravy with mashed potatoes and beans. A waitress shuffled down the corridor toward him with a tall mug of coffee. Rhys looked up to say some pleasantry. His eyes wandered from her to the scowling face at the window, and he gave a sort of little jump in his seat, and then grinned and waved. Sutry threw back the door and went down the aisle.
Hey, Sut, where the hell did you get to? I hunted everywhere for you.
Sure you did. Where did you get the money? I thought you were broke.
Sit down, sit down. Honey?
He raised a hand. He pointed at Sutry's head.
Bring him what he wants. Boy, I'm glad I found you. Here, tell her what you want.
I don't want a goddamn thing. Listen.
There ain't no need to cuss about it, the waitress said.
Sutry ignored her. He leaned to Rhys, who was loading his jaw with a forkful of steak. You're driving me crazy, he said.
Honey, bring him a cup of coffee.
I don't want a cupping fuck of coffee. Look, Rhys. Rhys lowered his head and gave Sutry a queer clown's wink and nod.
Sold 'em, he whispered. Look a here.
Look at what?
Down here, look a here.
Sutry had to lean back and look under the table where this grinning fool was holding pinched in his hand, so just the corner showed, a $20 bill.
What the hell are you hiding it for? Is it counterfeit?
Shh.
Hell no, son, it's good as gold.
Who'd you hit in the head?
Oh, buddy, we're going to take this to the Tong Games and come off with some real money.
We better get our ass down to the bus station is what we better do.
Honey, bring him a cup of coffee. He said he didn't want none.
Sutry slumped back in the booth.
Bring him some, said Rhys, waving a piece of cornbread. He'll drink it.
They stood in the street under the small lamps. A deathly quiet prevailed over the town.
I wished it wasn't summer and we could go to the cockfights, Rhys said.
He sucked his teeth and looked up and down the street.
Got to find us a goddamn taxi.
He patted his little paunch and belched and squinted about. Let me have a nickel and I'll go in and call one. Rhys doled the coin easily. Sutry wore a look of dry patience. He went in and called the taxi. When it arrived, Rhys opened the front door and hopped in and was whispering loudly to the driver. Sutry climbed in the back and shut the door.
Let me just take you fellers on up to the green room, the driver was saying. You can get anything you want up there. What do you say, Sut?
Sutry looked at the back of Rhys's head, and then he just looked out the window.
Of course you can go anywhere you want, said the driver. Daggone right you can, said Rhys. When you got the money to do it with.
He turned and favored Sutry with a sleazy grin.
What kind of whiskey you boys want? You want bonded or some real good moonshine? Is it real good, sure enough?
Bonded, said Sutry from the back. They were going by narrow back streets in the small town suppertime dark, by curtained window lights where families sat gathered. Sutry rolled down the window and breathed the air all full of blossoms. The driver took them up a gravel drive to the back of an old house. A yellow bulb hung burning from the naked night above them. The driver got out, and a man came from the door, and the two of them went across the yard and behind a garage. When they came back, the driver was holding a pint of whiskey down by the side of his leg. He got in and palmed the whiskey to Reese. Reese held it to the light and studied the label professionally as he unscrewed the cap. They went back down the driveway with Reese's head thrown back and the bottom of the bottle standing straight up.
"Get you a drink,"
he wheezed, poking the bottle over the seat at Suttree. Suttree drank and handed it back. Reese held the bottle up and eyed it and held it under the driver's chin.
"Get you a drink, old buddy,"
he said. The driver said he didn't drink on duty. They drove out through the small streets and struck the highway, Reese and Suttree passing the bottle back and forth, and Reese giving the driver a history of himself, no part of which was even vaguely true.
"Say, you all never been to the green room?"
said the driver.
"We ain't been up here in a long time," said Reese. "They got some little old gals up here who'll do anything. They'd as soon suck a Peter as look at you."
Reese was elbowing the dark of the cab behind him vigorously.
"You hear that, Sut?"
he said. They went out the highway several miles and turned onto a side road that had one time been the highway. At the top of the hill stood a squat cinder-block building with neon piping along the roof. The windows were painted black, and one of them was broken and fixed back with blocks of wood stove-bolted through the holes. There was an iron pole in the drive with a beer sign hung from the cross trees and perhaps 50 cars parked in the gravel. The cab driver switched on the dome light and looked at Reese.
"What we owe you, old buddy?"
"Let me have 5. That'll get the whiskey and everything."
Reese paid, and they stepped out into the gravel. The taxi slewed about in a cloud of dust and flying stones and went back out to the highway. Reese tucked in his shirt and hitched up his trousers and seized the door handle to make his entrance, but the door was locked. "Ring the buzzer," said Suttree. He pushed the button, and almost immediately the door opened, and a man looked at them and stepped back, and they entered. A concrete floor, a horseshoe-shaped bar upholstered in quilted black plastic, a gaudy jukebox that played country music. A few slow-eyed young whores in stage makeup and incredible costumes, ballroom gowns, bathing suits, satin pajamas. They lounged at the bar. They sat in the booths by the wall. They danced with clowns dressed up like farmers, wooden clown dances in the shifting jukebox lights. Through a door to the rear, Suttree could see thicker smoke yet and the green bays of gaming tables.
"God almighty damn," said Reese reverently. "Looky here."
Suttree was looking. He'd been in places like this, but not quite. A whole new style seemed to be seeking expression here. They crossed to the bar and were immediately set upon by whores. A black-haired girl in a chiffon dress with a train that followed her about the floor sweeping up the cigarette butts had Suttree by the elbow.
"Howdy, kitty," she said. "Why don't you buy me a drink?"
Suttree looked down into a pair of enormous painted eyes, dripping a black goo, a pair of perfectly round white tits pushed up in the front of her gown.
"You'll have to see this man here," he said. "He's the last of the big spenders."
She immediately turned loose of Suttree and got hold of Reese's arm, even though there were two other girls hanging on to him.
"Howdy, cutie," she said. "Why don't you buy me a drink?" "I'll buy you and Zola a drink quick as I get done at the tong table," cried Reese.
The bartender was standing at the ready, and Suttree held up one hand and caught his eye. He raised his chin to know what Sut would have.
"Bourbon and ginger ale," said Suttree.
"Where y'all from, honey?"
said a blonde who appeared out of the smoke. Suttree looked at her.
"Webb City," he said.
"You're a smart son of a bitch, ain't you?"
He watched Reese at the card table until he became bored and went back out to the bar. But the whores had thickened, and he got another drink and went back into the gambling room again. Reese seemed to have won some money, and Suttree tapped him on the shoulder to get some quarters and dimes for the slot machines. The dealer raised up and eyed him narrowly and told him to back off from the table if he wasn't playing. Reese handed him $2 over his shoulder, and Suttree took the money and went into another room and got change from a lady at a card table by the door. There were 8 or 10 slot machines along the walls, and several young men in dark gabardine shirts and their heads almost shaven were feeding money to the whores, and the whores were operating the machines. Suttree won about $7 and went back out to the bar and got another drink. He was beginning to feel a little drunk.
He bought the black-haired girl a drink, and she took him by the arm, and they sat in a booth at the far wall, and she immediately ordered two more drinks from a waitress dressed in a swimsuit and black net stockings. The black-haired girl put her hand on Sutri's leg and got him by the neck and ran her tongue down his throat. Then she stuck her tongue in his ear and asked him if he wanted to go out in the back. Reese came reeling through the smoke and the din with a painted child whore on his arm. She had an eye tooth out and smiled with her cigarette in her mouth to hide the gap.
"Looky here, Sut. Heidi, ain't that a pretty little old thing?"
Sutri smiled. Reese had her by the hand. He leaned toward Sutri.
"Listen," he said, "you wouldn't tell on a feller, would you?"
"Maybe not. Where's the whiskey?"
"Here. Hellfire, get you a drink."
He brought the bottle forth from his overalls and handed it over.
"You raise tobacco, too?" the girl said.
"Sure," said Sutri. Reese was making peculiar faces and jerking his shoulder at Sutri. Sutri spun the cap back on the bottle and slid from the booth.
"I gotta talk to my partner here a minute," he told the girl.
They conferred a few feet from the table. "Let's hear the bad news," said Sutri.
"Bad news is ass. Looky here."
He was cupping his hand at the mouth of his pocket. A roll of bills crouched there like a pet mouse.
"Oh, buddy, I strictly slipped it to him in yonder," he said.
The whore on his arm leaned across to whisper in Sutri's ear.
"You ought to get with Doreen yonder," she said,
nodding toward a puffy blonde at the bar.
"She's real sweet. We got to get us another bottle of whiskey," said Reese.
Both she and Reese had taken to hoarse stage whispers, and Sutri had to bend his head forward to hear them at all, what with the howl of electric guitars from the jukebox. As he did so, the old man seized him by the head and pulled him close and rasped in his ear,
"Go on and get her, Sud. We'll strictly put the dick to him."
When he woke, a light had come on in the cabin, and a man and a girl were standing in the door.
"That goddamn Doreen leaves her goddamn dates in the cabins all the time," the girl said.
Sutri groaned and tried to put his head beneath the pillow.
"Hey," said the girl, "you can't stay here."
His head was at the edge of the thin mattress. He looked down at the floor. The floor was pink linoleum with green and yellow flowers. There was a glass there and a half-pint bottle with a drink in the bottom. He reached down and got the bottle and held it against his naked chest.
"Hey,"
said the girl.
"Okay," said Sutri. "Let me get my clothes."
He wandered off through the weeds in the dark. Out on the highway, the sound of truck tires whined and died in the distance. He fell into a gully and climbed out and went on again. When he woke, it was daylight and he was lying in a field. He rose up and looked out across the sedge. Two little girls and a dog were going along a dirt lane. Beyond them, the sun-hammered landscape veered away in a quaking, shapeless hell. A low gray barn, a fence, a field wagon standing in milkweed. Yonder, the town. He rose to his feet and stood swaying, a great pain in his eyeballs and upon his skull like the pressure of marine deeps. He tottered off across the fields toward the roadhouse. He found Reese asleep in a wrecked car behind the cabins. Sutri shook him gently awake into a world he wanted no part of. The old man fought it. He pushed away and buried his head in one arm there on the dusty, ruptured seat. Sutri could not help but grin, for all that his head hurt so. "Come on," he said. "Let's go." The old man moaned.
"What?"
Sutri said.
"You go on, and I'll come later, tell him."
"Okay. You comfortable?"
"I'm all right."
"You want a sip of this cold lemonade before I go?" An eye opened. The musty, gutted hulk of the car stank of mold and sweat and cheap whiskey. Wasps kept coming in the naked rear window and vanishing through a crack in the dome light overhead.
"What?"
said Reese. "I said, would you like a sip of this cold lemonade?" The old man tried to see without moving his head, but he gave it up.
"Shit,"
he said.
"You ain't got no lemonade."
Sutri pulled him around by one arm. "Come on," he said. "Get your ass up from there and let's go." A bloated face turned up.
Oh, God, just leave me here to die.
Let's go, Reese.
Where are we at?
Let's go. He struggled up, looking around. How you feeling, old partner? Said Sutri. Reese looked up into Sutri's grinning face. He put his hands over his eyes.
Where you been?
He said. Come on. Reese shook his head.
Boy, we a couple of good uns, ain't we?
You don't have a little drink hid away, do you?
Shit.
Here. He lowered his hands. Sutri was holding the almost empty bottle at him.
Why, God damn, Sut, he said.
He reached for the bottle with both hands and twisted off the cap and drank. Leave me corners, said Sutri. Reese closed his eyes, screwed up his face, and shivered and swallowed. He blew and held the bottle up.
God damn,
he said.
I don't remember it being that bad last night.
Sutri took the bottle from him and let the little it held fill up one corner, and then he tilted it and drank and pitched the empty bottle out through the open window into the weeds. Well, he said, think you can make it now?
We'll give it a try.
He pulled himself painfully from the doorless car and stood squinting in the heat, little pleased with what he saw.
Where do you reckon they sell beer on Sunday up here?
Right here, probably, Sutri said, nodding toward the roadhouse. They passed among the cabins and staggered across the dusty waste of gravel and trash with their tongues out like dogs. Sutri tapped at a door at the rear of the premises. They waited.
Knock again, Sut.
He did. A slide shot back in the side of the building and a man peered out.
What'll you have, boys? He said. You got any cold beer? It's all cold. What kind?
What kind? Said Sutri.
Any goddamn kind, said Reese.
You got Miller's?
What you want, a six-pack?
Sutri looked at Reese. Reese was looking at him blandly. Sutri said, have you got any money?
No, ain't you?
He felt himself all over. Not a fucking dime, he said. The bootlegger looked from one to the other of them. Where's that pearl? Said Sutri. The old man raised his foot and put it down again. He leaned against the side of the building and raised his foot and reached down in his sock. He held up his purse. How come you still have that? Said Sutri. Did you not get any poontang last night?
You daggone right I got me some, but I never took off my shoes.
He undid the mouth of the thing and rolled out the pearl and held it up.
Looky here,
he said.
What's that supposed to be?
Said the bootlegger.
A pearl. Go on, take a look at it.
You sons of bitches, get on away from here, said the bootlegger, and slammed the little window shut. They looked at each other for a minute, and then Sutri squatted in the dust among the flattened cans.
Shit,
said Reese. Sutri palmed his knees and shook his head. We're hellacious traitors, he said.
Boy, I hate a dumb son of a bitch like that that don't know the value of nothing.
Let's get the hell out of here. It's a long way home. Coming over the Pigeon River Bridge into Newport, a county police cruiser passed them. The old man saw them coming.
Wave like they know you,
he said. Fuck that, said Sutri. The cruiser went by and Reese waved real big. The cruiser turned at the edge of the bridge and came back and pulled up alongside. A fat deputy looked them over.
Who you think you waving at, buddy?
Sutri groaned. Reese smiled.
I thought you was somebody I knowed, he said.
Is that right? Maybe you'd like to come uptown and get a little better acquainted.
He didn't mean anything by it, officer. The deputy eyed Sutri up and down, little joy in the beholding.
I'll be the judge of that, he said. Where are you two going?
Both reckoned one more wrong answer would be all that the law allowed. They looked at each other. Sutri could hear the river beneath them. He saw himself in a swan dive, heedless, lost, under gray, swirling waters. He could hear the cruiser's motor idling roughly with its high camshaft. Home, he said. The driver had said something to the deputy. The deputy looked them over again.
Well, he said, You better be getting on there.
Yes, sir, Sutry said.
Much obliged, your officer, said the old man.
They pulled away and turned at the end of the bridge and came back. The driver glanced at them in passing, but they were both looking at the ground.
Bastards, Sutry said. I thought for a minute there we were gone.
I knowed how to handle it, Reese said.
I told you not to wave, goddammit. And what the hell is your officer supposed to mean?
I don't know. Shit, my head hurts.
He was stumbling along, holding the top of his head with both hands. Sutry looked at him in disgust. We'd better get the hell out of here, he said.
We better not go through town.
Don't worry, said Sutry. We're not.
They turned down along the river, and Sutry took bearings by the sun and plotted a course cross-country that should bring them out on the highway on the other side of town. They went wandering mournfully down little dirt tracks and across fields. They went through a shantytown strung out along the edge of a branch, all grass and growing things about the creek and the encampment gone, a land of raw clay strewn with trash, with chickens and scabrous dogs. A cadaverous and dark-eyed people watched mutely, furtive and dimly defined in their doorways, such squalid folk as not even a weed grew among. Reese nodded and howdied to them, but they just stared. They crossed a pasture where grackles, blue and metallic in the sun, were turning up dried cowpats for the worms beneath, and they went on past the backside of a junk lot with the sun wearing hard upon them and upon the tar-paper roof of the parts shack, and upon the endless fenders and lids of wrecked cars that lay curing paint-lorn in the hot and weedy reeks. They ended up lost in a big alfalfa field. On three sides were woods, and on the fourth was where they'd come from.
Which way? Reese said.
Sutry squatted and held his head.
Will some son of a bitch please tell me what I'm doing here?
I got to get out of this sun before my old head pops, said Reese.
He looked down. Sutry had tilted forward onto his knees. They looked like castaways.
Don't lay down, said Reese, or you never will get up.
Sutry looked up at him.
You would absolutely pull the Pope under, he said.
He probably don't even drink. Which way do you reckon?
Sutry struggled up and looked around and struck out again. They crossed into heavy woods and began to climb. The ground was covered with random limestone, and there were sinkholes to be fallen into.
You take poison ivy, Sut?
No. Do you?
No, thank the Lord. I believe this here must be under cultivation.
They went on. They rested more and more going up the ridge, just sitting in the undergrowth like apes, eyeing one another with little expectation of anything and breathing hard. When they got to the top, they looked out and they could see below them, through the trees, a piece of black highway about 2 miles away.
I don't think I can make it without a drink of water, Sutry said.
Don't drink no water, Sut. It'll make you drunk all over again.
Sutry glared at him. When they reached the highway, they were stagger-footed and crazy-looking. As far as you could see, in either direction, there was not so much as a billboard. Sutry sat down by the edge of the road with his feet spread and began to pick at gravels and little straws and things.
Here comes a car, Sut.
Thumb it.
Well, get up. He won't stop with somebody setting down.
They watched the driver's eyes. He looked like a skittish horse the way he rolled them, and the car swerved out as if he'd keep from being leapt upon by these roadside predators who possibly fared on the flesh of motorists in lonely places. An hour later, they were still standing there. Three cars and one truck had passed. They looked at each other and at themselves. The old man fell to combing his hair with his hands.
"We better start walking," Sutry said.
How far from home you reckon we are?
I don't know. 20 miles? 30 maybe?
Sutry's eyes looked burnt, and a crusty paste had formed over his lips.
What time do you reckon it is?
Sutry looked at the sky, gently quaking like a vat of molten cobalt.
Past noon, maybe 2 o'clock. Let's walk on down around this next curve. Maybe there's a store or something. The old man shaded his eyes and looked down the hot and smoking road to where it dissolved in a distant haze. The landscape subsequent seemed to shift and veer so that he batted his eyes and made little gestures with his hands as if to shape things right again.
"I reckon we can try for it," he said.
They set off, stumbling along the roadway with their eyes down.
"If you keep from looking up for a long time, you can surprise yourself with how far you've come."
Sutry fell to counting the bottle caps in the dusty roadside gravel. Then he began to divide them into the right side ups and the upside downs. Before they reached the curve, he called for them to stop. Reese, when he looked at him, seemed almost in tears.
"We nail it to the curve, Sut," he said.
"I know. I just want to get rested a minute so that when we look down that next stretch of road and there's nothing there, I won't faint."
"How long you reckon a feller can sweat like this and nothing to drink without drying up?"
Sutry didn't answer. He was looking back up the road, the accrued flat of the surface making mirages of standing water on the heap-bleared black macadam. A truck was coming down, a phantom truck that augmented itself out of the boiling heat by segments and planes. An old black truck that rode down out of a funhouse mirror, coalesced slowly in the middle distance, and pulled to a stop alongside them.
"Shithouse mouse," cried Reese, staggering toward the truck.
Sutry thought that if he reached for the vehicle, it would resolve itself back into the cooking lobes of his skull from whence it came. But the old man was climbing up, jabbering mindlessly to the driver. Sutry followed. He pulled the door shut after them, and it bounced open again.
"Raise up on it," said the driver.
He raised up on it, and it shut, and they pulled away. As bad as they looked, bad as they smelled, this saint seemed not to notice. "How far are you going?" Sutry asked.
"Sevierville. How far are you all?"
He was a young boy, hair almost white, a light down at his chin and side jaws. "We'll ride on in with you if you don't mind," Sutry said.
"You more than welcome."
"Phew,"
said Reese.
"We was about give out."
Around the bend of the road was a store, an orange gas pump standing atilt. Sutry almost croaked out for a brief halt, and Reese watched the building go past with sadder eyes yet.
"Where you all from?"
the boy said. "Down around Knoxville. You from up here?"
"Nah," the boy said. "I'm from down around Sevierville."
He looked them over.
"I just come up here to mess around some last night," he said.
They watched the road in silence. Reese looked at the boy. He was wearing clean overall pants, and he was leaning up over the wheel, and he was chewing tobacco.
"You ever been to that there green room?" said Reese.
The boy looked at him sidelong, slyly.
"Shit," he said. "Ain't that the dangdest place?" "You wasn't in there last night, was you?" "We come in there by 3 o'clock this morning."
Reese looked at him again. He shook his head.
"Well," he said, "be proud you wasn't there no earlier. That first shift is pure hell, ain't it, Sut?"
When they stumbled back into the camp on the river, the four women and the boy were waiting for them with grim set mouths.
"Boy, if you ain't a couple of good'uns," she said. "Where's them groceries you was going to bring?"
"I can explain everything," Reese said.
"Where are they at? Hey? Boy, if you ain't a couple of good'uns."
Reese turned to Sutry.
"I told you she'd say that. What'd I tell you?"
Standing there with her hands on her hips and that stringy hair and her face a mask of bitterness, she looked fearful, and Sutry turned away. Reese tried to detain him to verify various lies, but he went on toward the lean-to and got his bedding and slouched off toward the river with it. He could hear the debate rising behind him.
"Sutry'll tell you. Ask him if you won't believe me."
He lay down in his blankets. It was growing dark, long late midsummer twilight in the woods. He wanted to go down to the river to bathe, but he felt too bad. He turned over and looked at the small plot of ground in the crook of his arm.
"My life is ghastly," he told the grass.
The girl woke him, shaking him by the shoulder. He'd heard his name called, and he rose up wondering. The boy was coming up out of the darkness downriver with a load of pale and misshapen driftwood, like scoured bones from a saint's barrow. At the fire, the woman bent and stooped and placed the blackened pots about, and the old man squatted on his haunches and rolled one of his limp, wet cigarettes and lit it deftly with a coal and watched. All this with a quality of dark ceremony. Sutri walked with the girl to the fire. One of the younger girls came up from the river with the coffee pot dripping river water and set it on the stones. She gave him a slow look sideways and arranged the pot with a studied domesticity, which in this outlandish setting caused Sutri to smile. They ate almost in silence, a light smacking of chops, eyes furtive in the light of the lantern. The meal consisted of the white beans and cornbread and the boiled chicory coffee. There was about them something subdued beyond their normal reticence, as if order had been forced upon them from without. From time to time, the woman awarded to the round dark a look of grim apprehension like a fugitive. When Sutri had finished, he thanked her and rose from the table, and she nodded, and he went off toward the river. He woke once in the night to the sound of voices, a faint lamentation that might have been hounds beyond the wind, but which to him, as he lay watching the slow procession of lights on a highway far across the river, like the candles of acolytes, seemed more the thin clamor of some company transgressed from a dream, or children who had died going along a road in the dark with lanterns and crying on their way from the world. It was the boy came down with poison ivy, first between his fingers, then up his arms and on his face. He'd rub himself with mud, with anything.
"I seen dogs like that," said the old man. "Couldn't get no relief." "His eyes is swole shut," the woman said at breakfast next morning.
The boy came to the fire like a sleepwalker, his arms puffed like adders. He tilted his head a bit to one side to favor the eye he could still see from. The skin of his upper arms had cracked in little fissures from which a clear yellow liquid seeped. The old man shook his head in disgust.
"I ain't never seen a feller swell up that away with poison ivy. What all do you reckon's the matter with him?"
"Just keep him away from me," said Sutri.
"I thought you didn't take it, Sut."
"I think he's found a new kind."
"Shoo," said Wanda. "You're a mess."
He came toward her, arms flailing stiffly in a fiend's mime, and she ran screaming.
"Well," the old man said, "you won't get it just being in the same boat with him." "I ain't going in no boat," the boy said. "You ain't you? I can't bend my arms."
Reese had a knife and spoon up in his hands, holding them like candles, waiting for the food. The boy was standing rigidly at the end of the table.
"You what?" said Reese. "Can't bend my arms," said the boy loftily.
The old man laid down his silver quietly.
"Well, hell's bells," he said.
He looked at Sutri.
"I reckon you and Wanda will have to take it today."
"I've got a better idea," Sutri said.
"What's that?"
"You and Wanda."
"Well, I thought I'd make the downstream run by myself. I thought I'd let you take the upstream with Wanda on account of she knows it."
The woman swung a bucketful of oatmeal onto the table, and the old man seized the ladle and loaded his bowl. Sutri looked down table at the boy. He was still standing with his arms out at his sides. Wanda was sitting at the table across from him. She did not look up. She seemed to be at grace. Sutri took the ladle and dolloped out the oatmeal. Reese was blowing on his, holding the bowl in both hands and watching Sutri across the rim. "Pass the milk," said Sutri. She sat with her knees together in the stern, facing him as he rowed, her hands in her lap, the braille drops swinging behind her from the poles. Sutri, seeing new country and asking about things along the shore, which side of an island to take. Her pointing, her young breasts swinging in the light cloth of her dress, turning in the boat, caught up in a childlike enthusiasm, a long flash of white thighs appearing and hiding again. Her bare feet on the silty boards of the skiff's floor crossed one over the top of the other. She said,
"Holler when you get tired and I'll spell you."
"That's all right."
"I row for Daddy all the time. I can row good."
"Okay."
"You like to work with Willard?"
"He's all right."
I don't. I worked with him last summer some. He's a smart aleck.
I guess you got to practice up on your rowing with him.
Shoot. That thing won't do nothing. You know, he tried to get me to hide out what pearls we found cleaning shells, and we'd slip off and sell them and keep the money?
Sutry grinned. Well, he said, I'd guess old Willard probably doesn't have much luck finding pearls. I'd say that everybody else would find about 5 to his 1.
Shoot, I bet he keeps what good ones he does find and hides them somewheres. Looky yonder at that old snake.
A water snake was weaving his way upriver by the shore reeds, his sleek chin flat on the water.
I just despise them things, she said.
They won't hurt you.
Shoot, what if one was to bite you?
They won't bite. They're not poison, anyway. She watched the snake, the tip of her thumb between her teeth. Let's just row over there and get him, and I'll show you, said Sutry, taking a hard turn on the larboard oar. She squealed and jumped, grabbing at the oars. Sutry could see down the front of her dress all the way to her belly, the skin so smooth, the nipples so round and swollen.
Buddy,
she said, high and breathless and laughing. She was almost in his lap.
You stay away from that thing.
The boat rocked. She steadied herself with a hand on his shoulder. She touched the gunwale and sat down, a shy smile. They looked toward the shore for the snake, but the snake was gone. The sun was warm on Sutry's back. He let one oar trail and wet his hand in the river and put it against the back of his neck. You scared the snake off, he said.
You scared me.
Maybe we'll see another one.
You stay away from them things. What if one was to climb in the boat?
I guess you'd be climbing out. Sutry suddenly looked down over the side. Why, here he is, he said, right alongside the boat. She squealed and stood up, holding her wrists together in front of her, her hands at her mouth. Sutry shook and jostled the oar. He's coming up the oar, he said.
Buddy,
she wailed, climbing onto the seat in the transom. She peered down into the water.
Where?
She said. Sutry had let go the oar and was laughing like a simpleton.
You quit that, she said. You hear, buddy?
Yes, he said.
You promise me, you hear? Don't do that no more.
Okay, he said. You better sit down before you fall in. She stepped down and sat, holding the gunwales at either side as if to be ready for rough water. He stood his feet against the struts in the skiff's side and pulled into the current. They ate their lunch on a grassy knoll above the river, a cool wind that bore an odor of damp moss coming off the water. Reese had gotten credit at the store, and there were bologna sandwiches on white bread with mayonnaise and little oatmeal cakes. She sat with her bare feet tucked beneath her and brought these things from a paper grocery sack and laid them out. When they'd eaten, he lay back in the grass with his hands behind his head. He watched the clouds. He closed his eyes. She took the oars as they went back down, and Sutry handled the braille bars. She would help him haul the filled brails in, smelling of soap and sweat, her body soft and naked under the dress touching him, the muscles dripping and swinging from the lines and clacking like castanets. They coaxed the loaded boat through the shallows, walking alongside it on the gravel floor of the river. Sutry raised the front of it by the ring in the prow and ran the water to the rear and grounded the bow of the skiff on a rock. Them leaning over the boat from either side, their heads almost touching, scooping out the water with bailing cans. Drifting downriver in the lovely dusk, the river chattering in the rips and bats going to and back over the darkening water, rocking down black glides and slicks, the gravel bars going past and little islands of rock and tufted grass. When they reached the camp, there was no one about. Sutry took the axe and went for wood while she built the fire back. He came up dragging some dead stumps and found her sitting in front of the fire on a tarpaulin she had spread there. She looked up quickly and smiled. He set one of the stumps in the flames. Hot sparks rose and drifted downwind in the dark. "Where is everybody?" he said.
I reckon they're at church.
You think Willard went with them?
Mama makes him go. She puts him to work if he tries to lay out.
Sutry sat down on the tarp alongside her. They could hear the river running on in the dark. He heard her breathing beside him, her breast rising and falling, eyes watching the fire.
Sutry rose onto his knees and reached across the flames and jostled the stump forward into a better place. He looked back at her. She had her knees up and her arms locked about them. Her full thighs shone in the firelight, the little wedge of pink rayon that pursed her cleft. He leaned to her and took her face in his hands and kissed her, child's breath, an odor of raw milk. She opened her mouth. He cupped her breast in his palm, and her eyes fluttered, and she slumped against him. When he put his hand up her dress, her legs fell open bonelessly. "This is nothing but trouble," he said.
"I don't care."
Her dress was around her waist, incredible amounts of flesh naked in the firelight. She was warm and wet and softly furred. She seemed barely conscious. He felt giddy, an obscene delight not untouched by just a little sorrow as he pulled down her drawers. Struggling one-handed with buttons, her thighs were slathered with mucus. She put her arms around his neck. She bowed her back and sucked her breath in sharply. Hers was a tale of bridled lust. He made her tell him everything. Never a living man. When he rose from between her thighs, the fire had died almost to coals. She sat and smoothed her skirt and swept back her hair. She got up and took up her fallen underclothing and went to the lean-to. Sutry saw her go with a basin toward the river, and when she returned, she had bathed and changed her dress, and he had mended back the fire, and she came and sat by him, and he took her hand. She came to him again in the night, where he slept above the river, waking him with her hands on him and her warm breath. She wanted to sleep with him, but he sent her away. She came back again toward the morning, and Sutry faced the day on buckling knees. He saw her coming from the river with a pail of water, smiling. He went up to the fire and found Rhys squatting there with his arms folded on top of his knees. Hot nights filled with summer thunder, heat lightning far and thin, and the midnight sky becrazed and mended back again. Sutry moved down to the gravel bar on the river and spread his blanket there under the gauzy star wash and lay naked with his back pressed to the wheeling earth. The river chattered and sucked past at his elbow. He'd lie awake long after the last dull shapes in the coals of the cook fire died, and he'd go naked into the cool and velvet waters and submerge like an otter, and come up and blow, the stones smooth as marbles under his cupped toes, and the dark water reeling past his eyes. He'd lie on his back in the shallows, and on these nights he'd see stars come adrift and rifle hot and dying across the face of the firmament. The enormity of the universe filled him with a strange, sweet woe. She always found him. She'd come pale and naked from the trees into the water like some dream old prisoners harbor or sailors at sea. Or touch his cheek where he lay sleeping and say his name, holding her arms aloft like a child for him to raise up over them the nightshirt that she wore, and her to lie cool and naked against his side. She sat in the bow of the boat, going upriver. She traced her cool fingertips along his nape, and he turned and squinted at her. Sunlight swarmed on the water. "That's going to get you screwed," he said. She knelt forward and ran her velvet tongue between his lips. She smelled of soap and wood smoke, tasted of salt. He turned the skiff toward shore, and he spread her naked in the grass, her grave and slightly smiling face pooled in black hair, her perfect teeth, her skin completely flawless, not so much as a mole, the nipples tulip-shaped and full, and her navel just a slit in her fat little belly. Her smooth thighs, her childlike shamelessness, her little hands dug into his buttocks, her whimpering like a puppy's. They swam in the river and slept in the sun. They woke in the hot forenoon and laughed at the hurry with which they worked. Rhys came down in the dark to help them moor the loaded skiff, and ran his flashbeam over the piles of shellfish, and the three of them went up through the trees to the fire. She sat across from him and watched him, and she brought his coffee, and pushed a soft young breast against his ear in taking away his empty plate.
"I believe that gal's a better cook than her mother," said Rhys. "What do you think?"
Sutry stopped chewing and looked sideways at Rhys, and then went on chewing again.
"That little old gal is special to me," Rhys said. "She'll just do a man's work."
Sutry spat an insoluble wad of gristle at the dark. The women were laboring up the slope with a wash tub of water between them, the girl laughing, the water licking over the sides.
You want some more coffee, Sut? Holler there and tell her to bring the pot.
And across the fire, her hot eyes watched him, and she seemed half breathless in the things she did. He walked off down by the river with his flashlight, along the path, flicking the light into the dead water by the shore, where suckers lay on the bottom, old bottles furred with silt, pale moon-eyed shad and catatonia. He turned off the light and sat in the easy dark and listened to a rip in some rocky shoal, a gentle whispering in the reeds where the river ran. A figure came down from the fire and squatted in the grass and rose and went back. The willows at the far shore cut from the night a prospect of distant mountains, dark against a paler sky. Half moon incandescent in her black galactic keyway, the heavens locked and wheeling. A sole star to the north, pale and constant, the old wanderer's beacon burning like a molten spike that tethered fast the small bear to the turning firmament. He closed his eyes and opened them, and looked again. He was struck by the fidelity of this earth he inhabited, and he bore it sudden love. In the morning, the boy helped them unload the mussels, sullen face filled with suspicion, a potential spy. The woman and the younger girls came up the river path with their shelling tools, the woman with her air of habitual rigidity and the girls in lockstep behind. At supper that night, Rhys said he thought the boy was well enough to work, and the boy glared at Sutri across the table. 2 mornings later, he was looking at Willard in the rear of the skiff. Willard wore a dark blue hat he'd come by somewhere, made of imitation felt, and maybe paper. Sutri rode with his head averted, watching the shore. They hardly spoke all day. By the time they'd unloaded the mussels downstream, it was getting on toward evening.
"Daddy's got a hole baited down here," the boy said. "Said for us to run his throw lines."
Sutri leaned on his shovel. "You go run them," he said. Willard clambered ashore and disappeared, whistling down the river path. He was gone the better part of an hour, and when he came back, he was lugging a good-sized spoonbill catfish, relict of Devonian seas, a thing scaleless and leathery with a duck's bill and the small eyes harboring eons of night. Sutri shook his head. Some like spirit joined beast and captor.
"Look a here," called the boy.
Sutri sat in the boat with his head in his hands. Darkness settled on them before they'd rowed halfway back to the camp. They spent the last hour rowing upstream, with the boy in the bow sounding with a pole, going up shoals where the oars grated on the gravel bottom and rocks passed along the planks with a slow, dull wrenching, fighting off tree limbs that kept boarding them in the dark. She came down to him at some hour before dawn and lay by him. She put her head against his chest. "We've got to stop this," he said.
"Why?"
"We'll get caught."
"I don't care."
"You'll get pregnant." She didn't answer. After a while, she said,
"We could be careful."
"There's nothing careful about us."
"What are we going to do?"
Sutri lay staring up through the trees at the night sky.
"Do you not want me to come anymore?"
He didn't answer.
"Buddy?"
"No," he said. His voice sounded strange. She lay there for a long time. They didn't speak. Then she rose and went back up the hill. He thought she would come the next night anyway, but she did not. He woke once and heard a rustle, night wind, a dog in the dark. One of the girls went down to the river and back. He got up and walked down the path and waded out and crouched there, looking across the dark current to the darker shapes of trees on the farther shore and the faint shoals of mist. In the third week of August, it began to rain. He and the boy were on the river when it started, and the rain was very cold, and they tucked their necks against it and put toward shore. Not drops, but whole glycerinous clots of water were falling in the river, raising great bladder-like wheels that exchanged with constant hissing pops. The boy's hat came slowly and darkly down about his face like a flower in an ink bottle until he looked out from a soggy cowl, his back hunched and his eyes planing about in deep suspicion. Sutri, at the oars, grinned. The boy half grinned back. His whole head was turning pale blue with hat dye.
"I ain't never seen it rain no harder of you," he said.
"What?"
"I said, have you?"
"No." They sidled into the bank, and Sutri boated the oars and took the rope in his hand and leaped for the bank. He went headlong and slid feet first back into the river, his hands dragging up great clawfuls of mud. When he came up, he was in water to his chest. The first thing he saw was the boy hugging himself dementedly. He slogged over to the boat and hung his elbows over it. "What the fuck are you laughing at?" he said.
"Phew," gasped the boy. "You look like a big spring lizard slipping off into the river."
"You simple shit. How about getting that oar and pushing us in?" The boy staggered up, still shaking his head, and took up the oar. They had drifted under some willows, and Sutri was holding onto the boat with one elbow and pulling on them. The rain was falling so hard it hurt. He got the boat tied and crawled through the willows and up the bank. There was a thick stand of cedars some little distance up the river, and he made for that, crawling under the trees, driving small birds forth into the weather. Within the copse, the day was darker yet, but the thick brown compost under him was almost dry, and he took off his shoes and emptied out the water and fetched the wadded socks from the toes of them and wrung them out. He took off his shirt and twisted the water from it and put it on again. He heard his name called off down by the river. He heard his name called in the woods. Water was beating down through the cedars and dropping all about him. He parted the boughs and saw the boy going up the river path with his hat hanging about his ears, and his face a mottled blue, and his arms flailing like an idiot wandered from a pest house. It rained for 3 days while they sat along the narrow strip of dry earth under the bluff and played cards, and while they mended their clothes, and Reese whittled first a flute from river cane, and then a snake with seed pearl eyes, and last a basswood bear he stained with shoeblack for the youngest girl. It cleared a little on the fourth day, and they tried to run their boats in the snarling yellow flood, but were glad to give it up. That evening, it began to rain again, and it never did stop. They laid up in the camp for 2 weeks and watched the river bloat and swell until it was screaming through the trees below the bluff, and the fields cross river were flooded far as you could see. The first of these days, Reese had kept a watcher posted in the skiff to set forth should anything of value come down. But soon the waters grew too treacherous for this commerce. They accumulated a strange collection of goods, which he sorted and divided among them, guided by inscrutable rules of equity. He'd squat for hours and watch the river pass, pointing sadly at valuables hurtling past with the speed of a train. He'd come back dripping and sit by the fire and shake his head. They spent 3 days shoveling at the mussels upstream, where the river was sucking away at the edge of the pile and taking back the shells. When they hiked downriver to see about things, there they found part of the bank washed out and a great crescent-shaped bite gone from their stacks. At night, she watched him with eyes full of questions. All were brought into such close and constant communion by the rain that the configuration of the family seemed to alter. A frailly structured matriarchy showed itself in these latter days, and Sutri reckoned it had always been so. Crouched there under the ledge in the wind's lee, while the flames of the small fire lapped back the dark, and all around and ceaseless fell the rain in the forest, they could have been some band of Stone Age folk washed up out of an atavistic dream. In the office of the old motel on the pike, Sutri had found a stack of moldering books, and he read through them one by one without regard, lying with his blanket for a lap robe, propped against the rocks. He read Tom Swift and his motorcycle, and he read The Black Brotherhood, and he read Mildred at Home. There were about a dozen titles, and when he had finished them all, he started over again. She read Mildred at Home, and a story about nurses. She said that she would like to be a nurse. He looked at her. She smiled thinly. When all were asleep in their places, she rose with her blanket folded about her and came from the lean-to and went down the bluff toward the woods. Sutri watched. When she was gone, he raised up and looked around. Then he pushed back his blanket and followed her. He caught her up just beyond the edge of the trees. She was all over him. It was raining lightly, and they were both wet. She was naked under her blanket. It fell in a dark pool about her feet, in which he knelt, rain dripping from her nipples, runneling thinly on her pale belly. With his ear to the womb of this child, he could hear the hiss of meteorites through the blind stellar depths. She moaned and stood tiptoe, her hands holding his head to her. These lovers lay crumpled in the dripping wood and listened to the fall of rain, heart on heart. Her wet hair lay across his face like black seaweed. She said his name. He moved as if to rise, but she held him. "You'll catch cold," he said.
"I don't care."
In their last week on the river, two possum hunters came upon their camp. They'd heard hounds coursing on the ridge behind them, and the hunters hallooed from the dark before they came up. Two figures, shambling in from the night like bad news, bearing a lighted lantern by its long bail, a shotgun held together with tape. They squatted on their haunches, side by side, like buzzards, and smiled around. Sutri looked at them. He looked at one, and then he looked at the other. They were alike to the crooks in their stained brown teeth, the creases about their eyes, the quilting of their dry bird necks. They squatted there and bobbed their heads and smiled and spat at the fire and said, "Howdy, howdy."
"Settin' warm," said Reese. "Hey, old woman, need some coffee cups over here."
"Howdy, howdy," said the possum hunters. "We heard Yoon's dogs a while back. Did they not tree?"
"Naw. Vernon here has got this young bitch, keeps a tree and flying squirrels. He's kicked her till she's flat on one side, but she don't want to give it up. Quick as I can see one to shoot, I'm going to tie it round her neck and let her wear it till it rots off. That'll break 'em every time."
"You all got dogs out?"
"Naw. We just camped up here getting muscles.
Danged if you fellas don't favor one another about as much as anybody I ever saw."
The possum hunters looked at each other and guffawed. Their chins jerked forward as if tied together to a wire, and they spat into the fire.
"We're twins," one of them said.
"I lied, maybe you was.
Most folks can't tell us apart. Boy, you can pull some capers on folks when you look much alike as me and Vernon does."
Reese took cups from the woman and set them on a flat rock by the fire and took up the old blue enamel coffee pot. He gazed at the possum hunters from one to the other.
"You all ain't got the same name, have you?" he said.
The possum hunters guffawed, and the one with the shotgun elbowed the other one in the ribs.
"Naw," he said. "I'm Vernon, and this here is Fernan."
Reese grinned. Sutri was leaning back against the slate of the bluff, watching them. They were thin and long-boned, and squatting there, their knees came almost to their ears, and their hands lay palm up on the ground before them in the manner of apes.
"Lots of folks thinks we got the same name," said the one with the lantern. "They're being so much alike. Don't that coffee smell good?"
"Just drink all you want,"
said Reese, pouring carefully. They hung their lean faces in their cups and peered over the rims. Reese was full of admiration and kept looking from one to the other of them, and shaking his head and looking about at various members of his family to see what they thought.
"We don't rightly know which one of us is which no way," said the one with the shotgun. "Mama never could tell us apart. They'd just kindly guess. Up till we was along in about 4 or 5 years old and could tell our own names. Before that, there ain't no telling how many times we might have swapped. We had little old bracelets, had our names on them, but we kicked them off first thing. I can't stand to wear nothing like that, nor Vernon neither. I just despise a wristwatch. One time we was 8 years old, I fell out of a tree and broke my arm. Vernon was at Granddaddy's. They wouldn't let me go for something I'd done. I fell out of a black walnut tree in the backyard and lay there hollering till Mama come and got me. Well, she run out in the road and stopped the car, and they put me in it and took me into Dr. Harrison. And we went up the steps to where his office was at, and there sat Vernon with his own arm broke."
The one with the shotgun grinned and nodded.
"We both fell out of black walnut trees at the identical same minute, 8 mile apart. I broke my right arm, and Vernon his left'un, and he's left-handed and me right."
"Pshaw," said Reese.
"You don't need to ask us. It was in the papers. You can go look it up your own self. We had that piece from the paper a long time." "We can tell what one another is thinking,"
said the one with the shotgun. He nodded toward the brother.
"Me and him can."
Reese looked at him, and then he looked at the one with the lantern.
"He can think a word, and I can tell you what it is. Or him, me, either one.
can't do it, Reese said. The possum hunters looked at each other and grinned.
What'll you bet on it? Well, I don't want to bet nothing, but I'd like to see it done.
They looked at each other again. They had a curious way of turning their heads toward each other, like mechanical dolls.
Go on over there, Fernan, and I'll turn my back.
The one with the shotgun turned around with a lithe, swiveling motion. He saw Suttree leaning against the rocks there, and winked at him and put his hands over his ears and bent his head. The other one rose and went toward Reese, and squatted by him and bent to his ear.
Tell me a word, he said. What kind of word?
Just a word, whatever.
Hush, whisper it in my ear.
Reese leaned and cupped his hand to the possum hunter's ear, and then sat back again. The possum hunter mouthed the word to himself, his eyes aloft. Down river came the thin cry of hounds, and across the flooded fields a yard dog yapped in the distance. The man with the shotgun raised his head and took his hands from his ears. The boy had come to the fire and was squatting near Reese, and the old lady and the girls were watching the hunter with a gun.
You got it, Fernan,
he cried out.
Yep,
said Fernan. The hunter opened his eyes. He squatted there motionless. His folded shadow, skewered by the shotgun, leaned across the slates. He looked at Suttree.
Brother,
he said. Suttree stood up. The hunter spun about and faced his unarmed image across the fire, his sinister isomer in bone and flesh. They hooted like mandrills and pointed with opposing hands at Reese. Reese drew back, his hand to his throat. Suttree took up his bedding and went down the face of the bluff beyond the firelight and through the woods to the river. In the morning, he walked out through the rain to the highway and looked down the long black straight. There had been a high wind in the night, and the wet macadam lay enameled up with leaves. He could have just walked off down the road. The old woman and the girls came in about 4 o'clock with some eggs and things from the farm upriver where they traded, and the old woman cast about with her sullen eyes as she did her work, kneading out biscuits and placing them in the iron Dutch oven, and piling coals with care onto the lid. It was past dark when Reese and the boy came in. They ate supper in silence. The rain that had fallen so small and fine all morning had ceased, and Suttree took his bedding off down to the river and lay there with his hands composed upon his chest, watching up at the starless dark, the shapes of the trees rearing dimly in the lightning. A distant toll of thunder, the sound of the river. Each drift of wind brought rainwater from the trees, and it spattered lightly in the leaves and on his face. He'd had enough of rain. The fire had died. He eased toward sleep. The next moment, all this was changed forever. Suttree leaped to his feet. The wall of slate above the camp had toppled in the darkness, whole jagged ledges crashing down, great plates of stone separating along the seams with dry shrieks and collapsing with a roar upon the ground below, the dull boom of it echoing across the river and back again, and then just the sifting down of small rocks, thin slates of shale clattering down in the dark. Suttree pulled himself into his trousers and started up through the trees at a run. He heard the mother calling out.
Oh, God!
She cried. Suttree heard it with sickness at heart, this calling on. She meant for God to answer.
Reese!
He called. There was no light. He stumbled on a clutch of figures on the ground, a sobbing in the dark. The rain was falling on them. He had not known that it was raining. In a raw pool of lightning, an image of Baroque Pietà. The woman gibbering, and kneeling in the rain, clutching at sheared limbs and rags of meat among the slabs of rock. One of the younger girls was pulling at her. The boy had come with a flashlight.
Don't,
said Suttree.
God Almighty,
said the boy. He snatched at the boy's hand. Get that damned light off of her.
Mama, Mama.
Oh, God, said Reese. Suttree turned to see him hobbling toward them, holding one knee. He knelt by the woman.
Where's that light?
He said.
I know I seen a light.
Suttree was kneeling by Reese. The cryptic lightning developed a rain-veiled face, stark and blue upon the ground. He took hold of a pale arm to feel for pulse. The arm was limp and turned the wrong way in his hand, and there was no pulse to it. Reese was clawing at the rocks, and the woman was moaning and pounding at them with her hand as if there were something dumb that might be driven off. Suttree took the light from the boy and cast it about. a havoc of old crushed signs and lumber, a pot, a mangled lantern. At the far edge of the slide, the youngest girl sat dumb and bloody in the rain watching them. He reached and took hold of the topmost slate and raised it and slid it back. They worked without speaking, and when the stones were all shifted, the old man got the girl's broken body up some way in his arms and began to stumble off with her. The flashlight lay cocked on the ground, and the beam of it angled up toward ultimate night, and the rain fell small and slant. He seemed to be making for the river with her, but in the loose sand he lost his footing, and they fell, and he knelt there in the rain over her and held his two fists at his breast and cried to the darkness over them all.
Oh, God, I can't take no more. Please lift this burden from me, for I can't bear it.
He left downriver in the dark, the oars aboard, turning slowly in the current, jostling over the shoals. The cottonwoods went by like rows of bones. Come sunrise, he was drifting through peaceful farmland upon a river high and muddy. He went along past grazing cows, their cropping in the grass audible above the clank of their bells. They looked up, surprised to see him there. The fields were spatched with beds of silt, and the shoreline brush wore shapes of wood and rags of paper all among the branches. He passed beneath a concrete bridge, and boys fishing called to him, but he did not look up. He sat in the skiff and held his hands in his lap with the dark blood crusted on the upturned palms. His eyes beheld the country he was passing through, but did not mark it. He was a man with no plans for going back the way he'd come, nor telling any soul at all what he had seen. He lay for days in his cot. No one came. The drums under one corner were banjaxed, and the shanty lay tilted in the water, so that he had to shore up the legs of his cot on one side with bricks. He did not put out his lines again. The windows in the shanty were mostly broken, but he did not turn out to mend them. The river filled with leaves. Long days of fall. Indian summer. He wandered up the hill one evening to look for Harrogate, but he did not find him. The musty keep beneath the arches of the viaduct was barren of the city rat's varied furnishings, and there was a dog long dead lay there, whose yellow ribs leered like teeth through the moldy rug of hide. He crossed the iron river bridge and went down the steep bank on the far side and came out on the railroad. Dry weeds among the ties, dead shells of milkweed, sumac, and mimosa. The old locomotive was half swallowed up in kudzu, and enormous lizards lay sunning on the tarred coach roofs. He went past the high-webbed iron wheels, the seized journals and driving rods, and the fat-coiled springs, and past the tender and rotting day-coach, with its sun-peeled paint and painless carriage sashes, to the caboose. There was no one about. He climbed the steps and pushed open the door. The place was littered with trash, and the little iron brakeman's stove had been kicked over, and lay with the rusted sections of stovepipe in a tip of ash and cinder. On the table, in the curious little bay window, lay a seal of yellow candle wax and two burnt matches. The old man's mattress was half off the bunk, and there was little trace of his having ever lived there. Sutri kicked at the trash, the cans and papers and rags, and went back out. He followed the old railway trace downriver until he came to the bridge, and here he called out the rag picker.
Who is it?
Sutri.
Come on in.
Come on out. The old man peered from his enormous vault. He came forth with reluctance. They sat on the ground, and the ragman looked at him with his fading eyes. Unkempt baron, he ekes neither tariff nor toll.
Where you been?
He said. I was up on the French Broad for a while. What's become of Daddy Watson?
I don't know. I ain't seen him.
Well, he's not living up here anymore. Don't you know anything about him? The ragman shook his head.
Here today and gone tomorrow,
he said. He pointed vaguely toward the ground as if perhaps it were responsible. Is he dead?
I don't know. I think they come and got him.
Who come and got him?
I don't know.
Shit, said Sutri.
Shit may be,
said the ragman.
I never took him to Ray's.
Was it the police?
It might have been any of them. I reckon I'll be next. You ain't safe.
I'll agree with that.
What happened to your boat, Shanny?
It sprang a leak.
I seen it go down some every day. I looked for it to go plumb in under.
Did he have any kin?
Did who have any kin?
Daddy.
I don't know. Who'd claim it if they was? I might have some myself, but you won't see 'em running up and down hollering it out.
No.
Nor yourn neither, maybe.
Sutry smiled.
Ain't that right?
That's right. The ragman nodded. You're always right.
I've been wrong.
How about Harvey? Is he still alive?
You couldn't kill him with a stick.
Harvey's right, too.
Drunk son of a bitch.
You're not the only one that's right. The ragman looked up warily. We're all right, said Sutry.
We're all fucked,
said the ragman. On a wild night, he went through the dark of the apple orchards downriver while a storm swept in and lightning marked him out with his empty sack. The trees reared like horses all about him in the wind, and the fruit fell hard to the ground like the disordered clop of hooves. Sutry stood among the screaming leaves and called the lightning down. It cracked and boomed about, and he pointed out the darkened heart within him and cried for light. If there be any art in the weathers of this earth, or char these bones to coal, if you can, if you can. A blackened rag in the rain. He sat with his back to a tree and watched the storm move on over the city. Am I a monster? Are there monsters in me? He took to wandering aimlessly in the city. He ate at Comer's, hot plates of roast beef or pork with vegetables and gravy and rounds of fried cornbread, Stud jotting down each day the new account and never asking for a dime. On the streets one day he accosted a ragged gentleman, going by in an air of preoccupation. Streets filled with early winter sunshine. Sutry had smiled to see him, and he tipped an imaginary cap. "Morning, Dr. Neal," he said. The old tattered barrister halted in his tracks and peered at Sutry from under his arched brows. Who'd been chief counsel for Scopes, a friend of Darrow and Mencken, and a lifelong friend of doomed defendants, causes lost, alone and friendless, in 100 courts. He pulled at his shapeless nose and waggled one finger.
"Sutry," he said.
"Cornelius, you know my father."
"For many years, quite honorably. And his father before him. How is he?"
"He's well. I see him seldom."
"Of course. And what line of work are you yourself in now?"
"I'm a fisherman."
"Into it commercially, is that it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Now that is interesting." "Yes, indeed. I'd say a lad with your head on his shoulders should be able to put a wrinkle into it that would make it pay."
"It does all right," said Sutry. He was swinging subtly about to recover the wind of the reeking figure he confronted, studying the patterns of gravy and food on the old lawyer's shirt and tie, his belt of baling twine, which had broken one day in the line at the S&W cafeteria, leaving him standing there with his tray in his hands, his feet hobbled in his old trousers, his thin old man's shanks the same dirty white as his shirt and as wrinkled.
"Always had a warm heart for the outdoor life myself,"
he said.
"All sedentaries, I suppose. Often wished I'd gone to sea. Have a brother in the Navy. Lives in the Philippines."
He scratched at his unshaven cheek and looked up at Sutry.
"You stick to your guns," he said. "Follow the trade that you favor, and you'll have no regrets in your old age."
Sutry wondered what regrets the old lawyer had, but he didn't ask. He took a turn down through the train yard. He'd a mind to see the station with the fireplaces and the inscriptions from Burns on the mantels, remembering his grandfather stepping down to the platform among the wheel trucks and the steam and the smiling black porter with the red cap. The old man's cheeks new-shaven and the fine red veins like the lines in banknote paper. His hat, his stogie. But when Sutry reached the station, it was closed. Had long been so. In the fine waiting rooms, boxes and cartons piled, great crates in storage. A few abandoned coaches and one Pullman stood on a siding, and old handbills hung bleached and all but wordless on the notice board. The yard beyond was rafted up with reefers and flat cars, teared hoppers, the romantic stencils broken over the slatted sides of cattle cars. Lackawanna, Lehigh Valley, Baltimore and Ohio, the route of the chiefs. He turned on down the tracks toward McAnally, where he spoke one day with an old man in a rocking chair. Old man watching out over Grand Avenue from his collapsing porch, taking the sun, a small dog in his lap. Save that he was thin and the dog fat, they looked a lot alike. The dog was a drab brown, the color of shit, and it seemed to have been inflated with a tire pump. Its eyes bulged, and it bared its teeth. The old man held the dog and rocked. He claimed that it had saved him from terminal asthma. Suttree regarded the bloated dog doubtfully.
"I wouldn't take a war pension for this dog," said the old man.
The dog looked sideways across its shoulder and snarled at Suttree.
"When I die, he's going to come to sleep with me. We're to be buried together. It's done arranged."
"It is."
"I want him just like this."
The old man held the dog up in his arms. "What if the dog dies first?"
"What?"
"I said, what if the dog dies first?" The old man regarded him warily. "I mean, if the dog dies first, are they going to put you to sleep?"
"Why, hell no, that's crazy."
"I guess maybe you could just have him frozen. Keep him till the time came." The old man hugged the crazy-looking thing to him.
"Of course I could,"
he said. The blind man at Suttree's elbow in the seeping dusk kept close with his mincing blind man's walk, and his hands wove images in the air to prove the things he said. They went down by steep little streets and took a trodden path through the winter fields. The blind man, to read his way through the thin soles of his old man's kid-skin boots, stepping like a heron among the gravel-strewn ties and down the slight embankment. Inside Jones's shanty, he nodded and smiled in the soft, archaic lamplight and the smoke. A scene from some old riverfront doggery, where cutthroats' eyes swang in the murk as if in appeal from their own depravity. Richard tottering woodenly in these strange surroundings, his hands outheld. Dahl closed the door behind them and looked at the blind man and shuffled away. Suttree showed him to a chair and went to the cooler and raised the lid, and dredged up two bottles from the water, and opened them, and went back to the table. The players' eyes flicked. Some nodded gravely. Ocean Frog dealt the last card and tightened the deck in his hand, and laid it on the table, and looked his way and winked. In the yellow pool of light from the lamp overhead, the crumpled bills fell like leaves. When the bottles clicked on the stained stone, Richard looked up and smiled, and reached and seized his beer with great accuracy. Suttree eased himself into the folding wooden chair, the varnish peened up in little black blisters along the back, where it had been salvaged from a riverside revival tent burnt years ago. The sun lay on the water behind them, and thin blades of light played through onto the far wall, dicing the smoke, casting the poker table behind frail and luminous bars. Richard felt the shack tilt on the river and said so. He tested the air with his nose like a rabbit. Smokehouse spoke his name, passing to the rear with empty bottles clutched in his hands, and Richard smiled and raised his bottle and drank. "See if you can cipher the names under the table, Richard." Richard looked at Suttree, or almost at him.
"Names?"
he said. "Under the table." He tapped with his knuckle. Richard ran a yellow hand beneath the marble slab, up among the 2x4s in which it sat.
"It's a gravestone,"
he said. "What does it say?" Richard smiled nervously, the pale blue clams in his eye sockets shifting under the useless lids, his ears tuned like a fox's to the world as he hears it. He slid his palm beneath the table and fished a cigarette from his shirt pocket with the other hand.
18 and 48,
he said.
19-07.
Two of the card players raised their hooded eyes to regard the blind man, but he minded them not.
"Williams," he said.
"It doesn't say who Williams?"
"No, Sut, it don't."
"Is that all it says?" Richard felt along the underside of the table.
"That's all,"
he said. He lit his cigarette and plumed two soundless streams of smoke from his nostrils. Let's move to another table. They rose and fumbled their way to the next table and sat again, Sutri steering him by the elbow through the chairs.